I want to bring us back to where we're holding in the tractate Shabbat, 16th chapter, and on the last Mishnah of our Perek. You'll forgive me, I have a little bit of a, I've been sitting all day and I need a little stretch. So, 16th Perek, we're at the last Mishnah. We started where if there was a fire on the Sabbath, could we save the texts? Remember, culturally, that they didn't want any translations of texts outside of the specific Hebrew ones within our possession in general, so that we wouldn't read these kind of translations of texts on Shabbat afternoon. Because what did they want on Shabbat afternoon to create the Shabbat culture? We should go back to the Beit Midrash and we should hear the sages Doresh Min HaTorah to make Midrashim, to make commentaries. And we don't only mean Agadic Midrashim. We don't mean legends of the Torah and narrative commentary and moral stories that come to, in their own way, teach the values that the rabbis want to share. We mean that there are Midrashic moves to create Jewish law out of certain verses whose application we need in our time if we are to create a Sabbath atmosphere. This is a very important thing to remember tonight. That was the first Mishnah. Here we are in the last Mishnah. We, of course, are relating to Gentiles about our relationships with them, about our living in close quarters with them, about our being and sharing a neighborhood. And the reason why we're in a Mishnah about that matter is because there was a Mishnah previous to this one that talked about whether or not one could say to non-Jewish neighbors, please come put out the fire. And that Mishnah was before this one, and here our Mishnah is not about putting out the fire necessarily, but what it is we can gain from a non-Jew doing on the Sabbath itself. We're going to look at this Mishnah again tonight. We're going to ask the same question I proposed last week, but I'm going to have a different pathway to answer it. Why does the Mishnah include a story about Rabban Gamliel at the end? There are two cases that come in a general way, within this last Mishnah of the chapter, and then there's a specific instance of what happens with Rabban Gamliel and the elders regarding Sabbath practice. And then that tonight is going to take us on an interesting look. We really only have about this much Talmud left for the chapter, and for the next 3 weeks we're going to find a way to understand on somewhat of a conceptual level the conceptual premise that I introduced before, that here's the buildup of the Sabbath culture. Also, the conceptual level that the Mishnah and the editors, or the editor of the Mishnah, had somewhat of a plan in terms of a first Mishnah in a Perek and a last Mishnah in a Perek. The first Mishnah in a chapter and a last Mishnah in a chapter, as that ancient book in the year 200 CE was formulated. And I'd like to use some of these weeks to look at that issue. And we're going to look at that issue through going to a few other places in the Gemara, because any one place in the Talmud requires a kind of three-dimensional look at rabbinic culture, rabbinic legal frameworks, rabbinic parlance. And we're going to go and look at another Mishnah in Eruvin and a piece of Gemara in Eruvin concerning Rabban Gamliel and the whole issue of being on a ship on Shabbat, because that's, remember, he was on the cruise and he got to shore and he walked down the gangplank that was set up by the non-Jew, and the question was, can he really walk down that plank to disembark? We're going to look at the Mishnah in Eruvin that relates to some of those issues about being on a ship, and then the overarching halachic category of having an area in which you can travel during Shabbat called Tichum Shabbat. And we're going to talk about that in relationship to what this chapter has presented to us from the first Mishnah now through to the last Mishnah. So even though we got lots of detailed law and discussion about the law before, about the Sabbath itself and the putting out the fires, and remember they stopped to talk about all the meals and all of the delights of the Sabbath and what true connection to the Sabbath will bring you in terms of reward. Now we're at that last Mishnah and we want to go through these sources to understand what other parts of the Sabbath culture are being articulated and how do we read our last Mishnah three-dimensionally. What else do we need to know to understand the depth of our Mishnah and the beginning part of the Gemara on this last Mishnah? The Gemara being the commentary and the conversation on the Mishnah. Okay, so that brings us to our Mishnah again, 122a1. If you're using this Art Scroll translation, it's on Daf Kuf Kaf Bet Amud Aleph. The Mishnah reads as follows. No chri shehidlik et haner. If a Gentile, a non-Jew, lit a lamp for himself, mishtamesh la'oro Yisrael, a Jew may use its light, ve'im bishvil Yisrael, asur. But if the Gentile lit the lamp for the Jew, one may not use it. So you have a philosophy of action. I, the Nochri, light it for myself. That someone would gain some use for this, Jew or non-Jew, yes, they can. Ve'im bishvil Yisrael asur. But if you lit it directly for the Jewish person, not gonna be allowed to use it. Mile mayim lahashkot behemto. If a Gentile drew water with which to water his own animal, mashkeach harav Yisrael. A Jew may water his animal after him. Ve'im bishvil Yisrael asur. But if the Gentile drew the water for a Jew, one may not use it. And remember last week we got into a discussion. What is this after him? Does a Jew wait till the water is used by the animals of the non-Jew who drew the water and then said, oh, there's some left. Now I'm going to bring my animals? Or, like some of the Rishonim said, does the Jew know, philosophy of action, that this person did not have me in mind entirely when he drew the water from the well, and thusly, I can bring my animals there. As a matter of courtesy, a human being like a mensch, I should probably let him go first, not race my animals to the watering hole. But since I knew he wasn't really doing it for me, I could then go water my animals as well. Asa nochri Kevesh Leredbo, if a Gentile made a gangplank upon which to disembark from a ship, Yored Acharav Yisrael, a Jew may disembark after him, Ve'im Bishvil Yisrael, but if it's really for a Jewish person, Asur, it's forbidden. Comes along a Ma'aseh of Rabban Gamliel. Last week we said, as one proposal for why the Mishnah had this example, is because A, you learn from what happened. In our tradition, sometimes you have a ma'aseh. That word means, look, there was an instance, and from that instance I can extrapolate what kind of legal approach I should take to such a situation. Two, we suggested that Rabban Gamliel is brought at the end of this Mishnah because the rabbis have a vested interest in telling us that Rabban Gamliel's authority is rock solid. And from him particularly, we can learn how to abide by Torah and abide by Jewish law. So what happened? Ma'aseh b'Rabban Gamliel uzakenim shehayu ba'in b'sfina. It once happened that Rabban Gamliel and the elders were arriving on a ship, va'asa nochri kevesh le'redbo, and a Gentile made a gangplank on which to disembark. Okay? V'yardu vo Rabban Gamliel uzakenim, and Rabban Gamliel and the elders disembarked on it. says in the note down below, although disembarking on the Sabbath is prohibited if the ship traveled beyond its techum, one may leave the ship if it reaches within 2,000 amot of the shore before the onset of the Sabbath. Rabban Gamliel determined that this was the case. Now, sometimes we just look at a footnote, we read it, and we say, nice, but I want to stop here and propose another answer as to why this Mishnah ends with the Ma'aseh of Rabban Gamliel. And I want to look at that Mishnah and a little bit of that Gemara that this footnote is reading in order to understand the situation here. Because it's enlightening by way of which halachic principles this chapter is pulling in order for us to get the greatest sense of what Sabbath culture we want to establish and abide by in terms of our Jewish community. And I think that Rabban Gamliel is here not only for the authority that we want to respect, but in order for us to respect the entire rabbinic project of legal precepts by which we will abide, we're getting this story that requires us to know this other piece, which is in Masechet Eruvim. I've explained before that an Eruv is what makes possible carrying within a courtyard, sharing food. But one of the more specific Eruvs that we can create regarding the Sabbath, or an additional specific Eruv we can create, is an Eruv Techumi. In Masechet Eruvin, we will get the instructions about how to create a boundary that instead of being four amot from the spot we find ourselves celebrating a Sabbath, four amot, only four amot, four cubits of space to kind of walk or travel, that our techum, our area in which we can freely move on any given Shabbat, becomes to the rabbis 2,000 amot, 2,000 cubits. And by having such an area defined for our Sabbath, we have a much more extensive space in which we can move. That's... So an amah is a matter of argument by some of the authorities. This is the reference guide that I have shown. It's Rabbi Steinsaltz's reference guide for the Talmud and Talmud study. And he says that an amah is a cubit. A number of different lengths are referred to by this name. The physical origin of the amah measure is the distance from the elbow to the end of the middle finger. The finger is also called what? The amah. This finger, the middle finger, I won't hold it up. That's called the amah. There's a very cute song in Hebrew to learn the different names of the fingers, because very rarely, even when you're learning Hebrew, do you have an opan that gets so detailed. So they, of course, with adults who are learning, it's sometimes very chummy to all sit and sing songs that the 4- and 5-year-olds chant through. But it's true that when you're learning and you're learning that song, then you start learning text. And you realize, oh, that's why. The amah is the middle finger. It went from the elbow to the middle finger. That was a cubit. So all these times when Noah was building the ark and it had to be so many cubits, huh? there you go. He didn't have a stick. He had basically this. So the common amah known as the amah beinoni, the standard amah, is 6 tefachim long. 48 centimeters. What's a tefach? That's a hand breath. Some say the hand breath is from this part of your palm to this. Some say you put your thumb there, and it's from the top of your thumb down to here. There was a machloket. Can you imagine? Some people's hands, guaranteed, if we did this with one another, this would be probably a measurement that had a lot more diversity around the human world. Anyway, according to the Na'e scale, it's 48 centimeters, but it's 57.6 centimeters according to the Chazon Ish. So you had different authorities who actually measured these differently by way of the number of centimeters in each one. However, the Talmud also mentions a short amma, which is called an amma bat chamisha, or an amma ketana, which is 5 tfachim long, as opposed to the 6. And in certain rare contexts, other amot are used. In addition, there were 2 other types of amot that were used in the temple for special measurements. One that was half a finger breadth wider than a standard amma, and the other that was a full finger breadth wider.
Why do they call it standard?
So you can see, measurements are even full of their own type of Jewish conversation. Okay, so the notion that you have this kind of area where a person needs to stay within their area of Sabbath is the underarching halachic principle, rabbinic creation, that's being demonstrated through a ma'aseh shehaya. Do I get that with the lamp? No. Do I get that with the watering hole? No. Here I have something very different by way of what the law presents. The case in this Mishnah allows me to perhaps link it to the cases above, but also perhaps to understand it within a legal framework which is not exactly related to the first Tannaitic claim about the lamp and the second Tannaitic claim about the watering. The Gemara is going to do a little bit of the work of trying to see internally how the Mishnah works vis-a-vis this third story, the story of Rabban Gamliel disembarking, and the two instances or the two cases or the two situations that the Mishnah presented at first. So let's look at the Gemara here before we go off to where I told you we're going to go off, to these other areas of law. The Gemara starts where it says Gimel Mem, about almost a halfway, a little above the halfway mark on the page if you're in the Ivri. Tanu Rabbanan. No, hold on. Gemara above. Gemara explains why the Mishnah presented the three illustrations of the same principle. So it's calling it the same principle at this point in the Gemara study. Vitzricha, or Utzricha, it was necessary to teach each of these three cases. What's the question behind the Tzricha answer? Do I really need these three cases to elucidate the principle you're trying to teach me? Utzricha, it needs it. De'i ashme'in aner, for if the Mishnah had taught us only the case of a lamp, Mishum dener le'echad ner le'meya, I would have said that a Jew is allowed to benefit from the lamp because of his following principle. Remember, what's the situation? A non-Jew lit the ner, lit the candle, so there's a light, right? And now the Jewish person can benefit if it wasn't lit specifically for him. What's the principle, the Gemara says, of why I can use it? Ner le'echad ner le'meya. A lamp illuminates for one, and a lamp illuminates for 100. In other words, it's the answer that we discussed last week. If I light a lamp in the room, in the salon, so the light's there. I'm not stealing your light. I'm using the light that's providing for me the same light is providing for you. Thus, since the Gentile lit the lamp for himself, one can't say that he did anything extra for the Jew. Now, we're not talking about a lamp that he can, you know, like move this way, like one of the little spots are that way, and then he takes the other reading lamp and is, you know, that's what we call in Rabbi Ben Zion Bergman's Beit Midrash, a klutz kasha. You know, so what if it's a lamp with the three things and he turned one this way and he turned one that way and he turned one this way? That's not the case. The case is it's a lamp. It's burning. It gives off light. Aval, Mayim, Ligzar, Dilmate la Pushe, Bishvil Yisrael. But with regard to drawing water, if I didn't have the case in my Mishnah, in other words, they're asking why the Mishnah had to be built the way it's built, it's proper to decree that a Jew may not use the remainder. I would have said that if I didn't hear the case. For perhaps the Gentile will come to increase the amount he draws for the sake of the Jew. So if I didn't have the separate case of water, I would have never permitted it. He sees the Jewish prisoner, he sees the animals, he has Rachmanis. He fills the extra water. And again, just noting what kind of attitude is represented, Ligabeha Nochri, regarding the non-Jew, this is one of those positive places in the Gemara where there's very humane understanding of what it means to be a person. And we pointed this out, that sometimes that's not so much the case in different places in ancient Jewish texts. The Gemara asks, V'kevesh lamali? And so, did I really need, though, the third case of the gangplank that was built off of the ship? Why, then, do I need the case of the gangplank? Right? What's the kind of reasoning why I wouldn't need it? Well, I could say a gangplank for one, a gangplank for 100. Ner le'echad, ner le'me'ah. I could use the same reasoning as I used in the case of the lamp. Because he had to get off the ship, right? The non-Jewish captain had to put the gangplank down. The porter. Somebody had to get off the ship. There were other passengers on the ship. I can't walk off on the same gangplank? No, it's the same exact thing as the lamp. Gemara answers the following. Ma'aseh the Rabban Gamliel zakenim kamash malan. The Mishnah uses that case as an introduction to inform us of the incident involving Rabban Gamliel and the elders. In other words, we must learn something more from that case. What are we going to learn more? The Gemara is going to have an answer. The Gemara cites a Braita that qualifies the Mishnah's law. Now, a Braita being cited by the Gemara comes to bring you what, again, the Tanaitic source that is authoritative, especially when it's written Tanu Rabbanan. This is a good Braita. This is a source we have from our ancient sages, the Tanaim, whose reflection on this matter is quite authoritative in and of itself. Tanu Rabbanan, Nochri Sheliket Asavim, if a Gentile gathered grasses for his animal, Ma'achil Acharav Yisrael, a Jew may feed his own animal after him. Now you see that after him here, in terms of our discussion from last week and what it meant, temporal or otherwise legal language. The note was a nice note here. The use of the phrase after him in this example and the one to follow is meant precisely, and it connotes the case of a Jew who sees a Gentile gathering grasses or drawing water without knowing the latter's intention. Only after he sees the Gentile feed or water his animal may the Jew assume that the Gentile acted on his own behalf, and the Jew may then use the grasses over water. Or the water. However, if the Jew knows for certain at the time of the gathering or drawing that the Gentile is acting in self-interest, the Jew may benefit from the feed or water immediately. That was the Rishonim that I read last week from the Matifta Gemara here. And the philosophy or difference in philosophy of action that we describe. First, considering, does this person set up the amount of feed with me in mind or not? And thusly, does the word after mean I'm just a little bit of a mensch, I let him start, but I send my animals right away? And it's not really about the one, two of the afterwards. It's really, I can follow suit and feed my animals and water them because I know that they're hungry and thirsty. They're my animals. So, then it says, Milei mayim lahashkot behemto. If a Gentile drew water with which to water his animal, mashkeach harav Yisrael, a Jew may water his own animal after him. Ve'im bishvil Yisrael asur. This is sounding exactly like our Mishnah. But if it's for a Jew, if a Gentile drew water for a Jew may not use it. But medivarim amurim. Regarding what circumstances are these leniencies stated? So that's a little bit different now. The Braita asks us, do we know anything more about these cases? Can we sense there was something else going on? What's the particular that we need to know in order to permit the Jewish person either eating the feed or drinking the water for their animals? She'ein makiro. When the Gentile does not know the Jew, that's when this permissive stance can be invoked. Why would I say that it's when the Jewish person doesn't know the non-Jew? Because that way I'm not making this kind of pact. He's not looking at me saying, oh, I know if only he could, because we know one another. And it's kind of set up that I'm doing this for you, even though you really shouldn't be doing this yourself. Exactly this way. By the way, yes, we have the halakha that we feed our animals before we feed ourselves. Yes, we have rahmanut, we have deep mercy on our animals on Shabbat, but how we draw water and how we gather feed. You know, if we have to borer, if we have to separate some of the grasses from inedible parts or parts that we don't want the animal to eat, that's a malacha. That's one of the 39 major categories of work that we have to refrain from because we don't want to break the Sabbath. So when he doesn't know him, that's when it's permissible.
You can't go to your friend's house to watch the Mets game.
Do you really need to go watch the Mets game? In other words, that question might be in today's world a spirit of Shabbat question. But if the TV was on from the get-go, if you asked him to do the TV, you're right. You in terms of our construct now, that would be the question.
He knows you.
There are two possibilities there of why one couldn't, because it's a spirit of Shabbat kind of thing with television, but it's also in terms of his turning it on for you if he wasn't likely to. Is he doing it for you or not? That's the kind of the parallel, right? If he knew you were a great sports fan and he did it for you and you know the guy, but let's say you're walking by a bar, right? There's the case in New York. How many games are on? Like, I can go find the hockey game, the baseball game, the other basketball game, this one who subscribed to this game that I couldn't subscribe to. What can I do? Can I stop on Shabbat and watch that game?
Yes, celebrate the creation of the human body.
So there's the...
On the sidewalk or inside the park?
No, on the sidewalk. Yeah, to cross the threshold is a whole different story, right? That's ona'at davar. You would otherwise buy a drink. But now you're really, you know, you're saying to the shopkeeper, sorry, buddy. That's a whole different category of fraud, trickery.
We learned earlier that you couldn't ask a Gentile to do something you wouldn't do. But here it seems that we're not asking the Gentile. The Gentile is just doing it. And yet, under certain circumstances, we're still forbidden from taking advantage of that. I'm not sure
right
what the difference is between this and the prior learning.
So this is exactly part of the workout. of that issue. We're in that issue. Before, with the fire, I couldn't say go put it out, and I didn't want to say don't put it out. Right? Put it out, it would have been my avera. I would have been the sinner. I would have been breaking Shabbat. I can't do that. But I don't have to say stop. Why? They don't have shvut. The non-Jew doesn't have to rest. The same categorical laws of Shabbat doesn't, they don't apply. And working on the concept that they might be rewarded, they have an interest. They're at least going to have a nice meal if they go in and save food from the house that's burning down. Let alone some money that they might expect by way of reward. Here, I have a similar yet different set of issues. Now the Gemara, the Mishnah and the Gemara want to talk on a more broad-based conceptual level. Let's talk about how you're going to create Shabbat community with non-Jews around you. Whether they're hired in your house, or they happen to be neighbors, or in some cases that they're operating, even a ship you might be on. How do I relate to keeping Shabbat, keeping the law? Gaining and benefiting from what they're doing that I know is somehow linked legally to what I'm not allowed to be engaged in. And the workout right now is, oh, if it was done specifically for you by the non-Jew, you can't use it. Now, in terms of amira lenochri, what we say to a non-Jew, has anybody said anything about what we say to a non-Jew in this Mishnah? No. It's an area of law that we're going to develop and investigate in the next 2 weeks in class. And I want to show you some of the sources that developed around just this issue. And what we mentioned last week, which is the concept of Shabbos Goy. But right now, in terms of the Mishnah itself, where we are in the chapter and how the law is working, being worked out, how the law is turning out, we're talking about the actions of others and whether or not I can benefit. So that's where it's all fitting in the narrative.
So what the Jew should do if somebody who I don't know, like the light in the corridor that I got in, so I'm not going to fall or something. Mm-hmm. What I should jump through the window, what I need to do. What should someone do in case that somebody did something specifically?
Well, first of all, if you go with the thought of the Gemara here, that it is ner lecha, ner lemea, and that light for one is a light for 100.
I wanted to go to the bathroom, so the servant switched it on just for me, so what, I don't go to the
right,
bathroom.
So we're going to look at when a Jewish person has a non-Jewish person within their home, whether it is by saying so, like turn this on, or by hinting at it, or by an understanding you create before Sabbath, the rabbis will have what to say to you in terms of how to live that out. We're not there yet, but we're going to look at those sources. Here, I'm asking, can I just benefit if they flicked on the hall light? Back to your example. What's the answer so far? Yeah?
Yeah,
but if he saw you walking and he's worried, I could walk this in the dark. If I did this just for you. No, because I think in your example you said he flicked it on to walk through himself, right?
No, he did.
Oh, just for you.
No, because he doesn't know me. He works in this place. I went through a dark corridor.
Okay, so he doesn't know you.
I thought you were going to the bathroom.
Or the bathroom.
Right, that's why I'm just trying to figure out. Are we going to the bathroom? Or are we walking forward? No, obviously, but the question is, what's the specific one we're talking about? And with what we know from the Gemara right now, what are we saying about that particular instance? So there's no extrapolating to all cases. That's the nice thing about law, right? So we want to know. If the guy looks at you and says, I'm turning on this light for you, I don't need it, then a person who wants to follow the law as we understand it from this Gemara would say what?
You cannot use it.
I can't use it. Close your eyes. I'll tell you, you know, This is what's good about being in an adult Talmud class, right? Somebody was at a home where there was just simply nobody to turn on a light in the bathroom. They were very observant people, and no one in that home was going to be allowed, whether that was your shita or not, whether you used electricity, no one was going to be allowed to do that. And the host of the meal said, "Listen, I want to apologize. The bathroom here, and there was only, it was an apartment in Jerusalem, there was only one. The bathroom here has no light. Is there anyone who doesn't know where everything is?" And there was this kind of chuckle of agreement that people were going to understand that there was going to be no mila achar yad. What we say about certain instances is that mila achar yad with a shinui, with a change, mila achar yad, doing something kind of a different way with your hand, and there's another use of the word achar in a different way, not temporally, right? We say after your hand. It doesn't really translate legitimately. Mila achar yad is a halachic principle. It's a legal principle that says, if I do something differently, maybe I could accomplish this. But it wasn't accomplished. It wasn't going to get accomplished. No one wanted to permit that in terms of the household. And they didn't for sure want to have somebody use the light if it was erroneously turned on. So these are specific instances where people have to make these decisions. We've talked about this before in terms of applying the law in these moments and feeling like one is connected to a greater Sabbath observance despite the feeling that one needs a light for a bathroom or this room or that room, or one wants to read on that couch and forgets to turn on the light, or goes into the closet and the light wasn't on. And the overarching principle that they're arguing, well, if I don't look presentable, then I won't really make the good impression, and this and that, and therefore I should be able to go back and turn this on. Well, not all the time does that jumping jack work that way. In other words, the kind of feeling that, I'm looking at Charlie because you suggested before that, perhaps one way of thinking about celebrating the body and watching that sports game for a minute, even if one was concentrating on this beautiful notion that team sports have within it a certain wisdom, the body as the vessel of God, if I can bring that kavanah, that intentionality to my watching the Mets, maybe they need my extra inspiration that way. But that is not the acceptable pathway towards making allowances that all the time happens within communities who respect Shabbat observance. So that's at hand here, some of these types of approaches. Let's look at the end of this little passage of Gemara so we could go to this other Mishnah. So that's only when what? He does not know the Jew. Only then may the Jew derive benefit from the remaining grasses and water. Aval, but makiro, but if he knows him, it's just now saying what we knew it was going to say. Asur, if he knows, the Gentile knows the Jew can't benefit from the Gentile's labor. The Gemara first questions how one's permitted to use grasses picked on the Sabbath. Wait a minute. The issue was not necessarily borer, which I explained before could be an issue in separating out the good grasses from what I didn't want my animals to eat. But I can't uproot plants. I think I've told you this before. We used to sit on the migrash on the field at Camp Ramah on the Sabbath, and particularly on the Sabbath, we would teach the kids that, and this was a problem all week because we didn't want them to pick out the grass in the field anyway. Actually, up at Berkshire's and in Canada, where we said, stop picking the grass to begin with. It's not up to you when the grass dies. Let it be God's decision. But on Shabbat particularly, we didn't want them to be uprooting, and this was all linked back to the notion that we don't plant or harvest. And we tried to teach them in a real kind of moment when we're all sitting in the outfield that, learn to leave that be. Learn to let the field be the field, and you guys enjoy the Shabbat. We're going to play some ball. So that's a problem within the whole picture here of feeding one's animals. Can I really benefit from that? was I asking the Jew, or the non-Jew, as a Jew, was I asking the non-Jew to harvest for me? That's completely forbidden. So that's what the Gemara says now. But Rav Huna says in the name of Rav Hanina, Vaha ma Rav Huna ma Rav Hanina. Ma amid adam behemto al gabe asavim b'shabbat. A person may stand his animal over still attached grasses on the Sabbath. An animal can still eat from the grasses that are attached to the earth. That's not considered harvesting for you. Aval lo al gabe muktzah b'shabbat. But not over muktzah grasses on the Sabbath. What are those? So he says, that is, one may pasture his livestock on the Sabbath, allowing them to eat grass still attached to the ground, but one may not leave them to already harvested grass or feed that is sitting around on the Sabbath, because that's muktzah. That's what I would not touch myself from such a pile. It was not designated for my use, is another piece of the philosophy of mind that I have to remember about it, because if I did have some that I was going to use to fulfill the mitzvah of feeding my animals, because I know I have the mitzvah of feeding my animals before, that I can use. In both cases,
what's the difference?
The difference is simply philosophy of mind. I set this as an item that I'm going to use to fulfill my obligation, and all this other stuff, if I touch it, I'm going to violate the Sabbath.
If you touch it, the cow doesn't know from one pile to another.
Well, Rav Huna said in the name of Rabbi Hanina that in terms of the way we practice feeding our animals, we don't send them over that pile. I send them over the pile that is either still grass or the stuff that I designated. And we agree to that. The distinction between the cases lies in the severity of the potential Sabbath desecration. In the first, uprooting is a deraita prohibition. It's a biblical prohibition. It's a Torahitic prohibition. It's that higher level of prohibition within the rabbinic system. Since it's unlikely that one would carelessly perform it, the sages saw no need to decree a safeguard. However, if one stands over his animal as it eats harvested muktzah grass, it's possible that he'll pick up some of the grass and feed it to his animal. And therefore, muktzah is this rabbinic ordinance that says, I'm not going to pick this up and I'm not going to then feed it. Because feeding it in and of itself, you would say, well, maybe that's possible. But this particular stuff that I didn't designate, I want to be careful enough to do it. Okay, so the Gemara is now going to answer. The bride speaks of where the Jew stands in front of the animal. The azla hiva achla, and the animal goes of its own accord and eats the grass. This method is permitted. Okay, so it's a workout, and it's done, and we have that. But the Gemara now poses a question on the Mishnah for the bride's qualifying statement. Amar Mar, Master said, the bride stated in its conclusion, regarding what circumstances are these leniencies stated, that Jews can use the stuff, that Jews can benefit? She'ein makiro, when the Gentile does not know the Jew. Ava makiro asur, but when he knows him, it's forbidden. Ha, Rabban Gamliel, makiro hava. You're telling me that Rabban Gamliel didn't know the guy who put the gangplank on? He didn't know the guy who was on the ship who set out the gangplank so that they could all disembark? How big do you think this neighborhood is on the ship? We're not talking about Carnival Cruise Lines here. We're talking about a boat. And by the way, Rabban Gamliel must know the guy who's setting this up.
Certainly knows he's not Jewish.
Amar Abaye. And Abaye says, Shelo b'fanav hava. I got the answer. Rabban Gamliel wasn't in the Gentile's presence when he made the gangplank. He didn't see him. He didn't know he was doing it. And hence, what? The Gentile didn't look over to him and say, hey, Rabban Gamliel, I'm putting this up now. Come on, you can get off. It wasn't for the Jewish person. It was that he would put it down and that it wasn't a particular act to benefit the Jewish person.
That's why you have a mashgiach, right? Otherwise you're going to say, I didn't see it make good.
That's right. This is a little bit of a overlook. Rava says, Afilu tema bifanav. No, he says, Abaye, look, even if you told me that Rabban Gamliel was in the Gentile's presence, when that gangplank was constructed. Ner lecha, ner lemeah. I can apply the legal principle. A candle for one, light for one, is light for everyone. A lamp illuminates for one, and a lamp illuminates for 100. Similarly, the same gangplank is going to be for anyone who wants to disembark the ship, and therefore Rabban Gamliel can benefit from it like anybody else. The Gemara challenges Rava's answer to Abaye, though. That's how you're going to figure it out. Meitave. I have a challenge. The Meitave technical term comes as a challenge to a Braita that's going to prove the case. Or definitely to an Amoraic statement. Who are Abaye and Rava? They are Amoraim. They are post-Tanaitic age sages who are having a machloket. They're having what's called a machloket, an argument. Abaye said no, he wasn't in his presence, and the guy then put the gangplank up and he didn't benefit Rabban Gamliel directly. And Rabban Gamliel doesn't have to worry about it. It was for him particularly. Rava says, well, even if he was there, I'm going to apply the legal principle that we established in the early part of this discussion. Ner lecha, ner lemeah. Put up one candle, light a light. I can sit in the room and read. He's not doing it.
You said that all three examples were going to illuminate different points. So.
No, so the presentation of the Gemara is that they're illuminating one.
All three are for the same.
That's the one. That's where I think the Gemara is going to leave it in a second. But I'm not.
I want to buy it to live once.
I want to argue that it's not illuminating only one, though. In this part of the Gemara, they're saying ner le echad ner le meya. Light for one is light for all. If the guy doesn't have particularly the Jewish person in mind, the Jewish person there can benefit. All three examples basically came to say that. I might have thought otherwise if the examples weren't brought, by the way. Right? With the light, I could use it, but with the water, I could never justify it. That's why the case came. And by the way, with Rabban Gamliel, according to Rava, even if Rava's standing right there, it's the same principle. Gangplank for one is a gangplank for all. He could come off.
But then why isn't Rava smart enough to know that if he's using the same principle for the gangplank as for the fire, therefore you don't need both of them.
You don't need it, but it presented it so that there would be a certain, and this is where I think the Mishnah does kind of give you different examples to bring home a point in different scenarios, whether it's about feeding animals, learning Torah, or disembarking from a ship, I can apply the same principle. So I still might need the different cases so that I can see the application of the principle in different areas in which I will be involved in my Sabbath observance. But legally, in terms of legal principles right now, we're not necessarily in the way the Gemara presents it in Shabbat, dealing with the complexities of Sabbath observance beyond this kind of approach of when a non-Jew does something and might benefit from either the light, the watering, the feeding in this case, because it was added, and the disembarking from a ship. Except that you can't get away from the question in terms of the disembarkment of one of the major principles of Sabbath observance and areas in which we're allowed to walk and travel, which is the three-dimensional read that we're going to go to by looking at the Eruvin Mishnah in a second after we finish just the last statement, and that is the bright that comes to reject this notion of Rava. Amar lehen Rabban Gamliel. Rabban Gamliel said to the elders, Ho'il shelo b'faneinu asa'on nevred bo. Since he made the gangplank outside of our presence, let us disembark on it. So the Gemara reinterprets the Braita. Ema say that Rabban Gamliel meant thus, Ho'il v'asa'o neredbo. Since he made it, and in fact, expended no extra effort on our behalf, let's walk out. Let's go. Again, same principle coming back. He made no extra effort for us. He knew we were among the party. He knew we were among the party. But out of our presence, physical presence, we're okay. maybe a little bit of adjustment by way of it wasn't exactly in their presence, but what he meant was same kind of principle. Light for one is light for all. That takes us, though, to this area, though, that we really are talking about in a certain sense, and I was hinted at in one of the footnotes, and that is the Techum Shabbat, the area in which I can travel, walk, exist during the Sabbath. How does the Rabban Gamliel ending in the chapter, in the Mishnah, and thusly as the last Mishnah of the chapter come to expand our horizons in this way? It comes because if I didn't have the Rabban Gamliel third case, I wouldn't necessarily think about this just by the examples of the watering or the examples of the feeding or the light. Even the feeding, because that was part of the Amoraic discussion in the Gemara. So I wouldn't have any of that. So let me pass this out to you. If you'll take one of these packets and pass them around. All right. If we were learning in Masechet Eruvin, we would have had an introduction to the tractate. I mentioned it once in class that there was an entire Masechet after Masechet Shabbat, after tractate Shabbat, just written on different conceptions of an Eruv. In other words, the setup, the physical setup and the legal conception that I make areas in which I can carry, walk, travel. I have areas now in which I can share food house to house, and I have to set this up with certain Hebraic formula and also with physical actions. A Techum Shabbat, I'll just read you a little bit from here, is the following. On the Sabbath of festivals, a person is forbidden to go more than 2,000 amot from his legally defined residence at the beginning of that day. The limit is called a techum, a boundary, an area. Rabbi Akiva maintains that this is a biblical prohibition, deoraita. But the sages consider it derabbanan, a rabbinic prohibition. The halacha follows the sages, so it's derabbanan. To calculate the techum, we must first determine the person's place of residence at the beginning of the Sabbath. This place, known as his Makom Shvita, his place of making the Sabbath, is generally identical with his actual residence for the Sabbath. A person's basic place of residence is 4 amot. So I have these 4 amot in my basic spot. However, an entire town is considered the equivalent of 4 amot. So when I say 4 amot, I don't mean 4 of these. I mean my David amot, which has come in Hebrew parlance to mean you're in my space. You know, like if I wanted to have a Hebrew equivalent to saying you're in my... But my space, in terms of my Sabbath observance, is my whole town. And right, Ron is right, it's movable. So it's not just my house, as in my sofa. It's the town limit. So if I take the town limit here, at the fence of the town, and I live in the center here, and it's kind of like that. So if I take the limit here, and I go 2,000 amot that way, right? That's my Techum Shabbat. As long as what? How do I create that Techum Shabbat? What do I need to do to make those 2,000 feet the actual Techum? What I do is... It's possible for a person to formally establish his Sabbath residence in a place other than where he actually is. This is done by making an Eruvei Techumin at the location up to 2,000 amot away from your actual location. This legally establishes his Sabbath residence at that location and enables him to proceed from his actual location to that point and 2,000 amot beyond it. So that outside place in my town and then 2,000 feet beyond it. In effect, it enables him to go a maximum of what though? 4,000 amot. I can go 2,000 to that point and then even 2,000 more from his actual place of residence, since he may establish the Eruv up to 2,000 amot away from your actual spot. This does not give him more than the 2,000 amot limit. It merely shifts the point from which it's measured. For example, if one sets the Eruv at a point 2,000 amot away from where he'll actually spend the Sabbath, he'll be able to travel 4,000 amot that direction. Okay? There are two ways to set an Eruv Techumi. One, you go to the desired location and staying there until the Sabbath begins, you've now established it by staying there. And two, by placing for this purpose a specified amount of food at that location before the Sabbath. The place where the food has been placed is then viewed as your legal Sabbath residence. Either way, the person is viewed as symbolically residing at the location where his Eruv is. So it's not the Eruv Chatzeros. I think I heard someone, you know, you put up the planks and you put up the strings and you make what's considered a boundary with this legal set of doorways. That's not this Eruv. That's an Eruv Chatzeros. That's an Eruv. We're talking about Tchumin and a Mavoi and the alleyway and the Eruv Chatzeros and the Shitufei Mavos from bringing the foods together to make a communal courtyard and to have a car to have a what they call here the karpas. Some areas are given karmelite status even though they're enclosed within partitions conforming to the rules set down for a reshut ha-yachid. Remember to make a reshut ha-yachid a private domain with these spaces, and then you're able to carry back and forth, and then you need to make these kind of special eruv chatzeros, the shared food by way of formula and shared food items. These are different than the techumin, the one we're talking about now. What's important for us...
But why do we need it? Why does someone need to go 4,000?
You want to visit your uncle?
Well, it's an interesting question. So, I want to visit somebody, and I want to leave this area. That's one. The other area that we'll get to, if we have the time, is someone's coming to a certain town and giving a lecture in the synagogue. I want to go to that lecture. So I need to make my Eruv Tchumi, my area, inclusive of that synagogue. Because I know a sage is coming. So hold that thought as we go into the issue. What's interesting about this issue is that it's going to apply to even when we're talking about being on boats. So let's go into the Mishnah and see where that issue, how that issue manifests within the Mishnah concerning traveling on a ship, or a Mishnah traveling on a ship on the Sabbath. Okay, the Mishnah on the handout, the first page, page one at the bottom. Misha hotziuhu nochrim o ruach ra'a, one whom Gentiles removed from his tachum. Or an evil spirit temporarily deranges a person and it causes him to go outside his tachum, his area, his border for the Sabbath. Ein lo ela arba amot. He has no more than 4 amot now. This small area, this small kind of private space at his new location in which he's permitted to move. Although he's left his tachum unwillingly, says the translation, he's nonetheless beyond his boundary. And his movements are therefore restricted to 4 amot. Now, obviously that's something that's pretty serious by the rabbis. If they're saying even by force he's removed, and it's the Sabbath, you need to stay in your private space. Right? That sounds pretty serious. Hechaziruhu, if they returned him to his tichum, to his area, ke'ilu lo yatsa, it's as if he never left. And he may once again move throughout the whole Tachum area he established at the beginning of the Sabbath. So now you're back. You got the whole place to your 4,000 amot are yours. Holy chuhu le'ir acheret, if they took him to another city beyond his Tachum. Nitanuhu badir o v'sahar, or they placed him in a fold or a corral, which is beyond his tachum, right? Yeah, so you have a sheepfold, or you have a corral, where you have different types of animals that you keep in such an area. What do you do? Rabban Gamliel, the Rabbi Elazar ben Azaria Omrim, the Rabban Gamliel and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah say, he may move about the entire enclosure. Although he is now beyond his tichum, and the law therefore restricts his movements to what? Four amot, which is a small little private space, the entire enclosed area is treated as the equivalent of four amot. In other words, what's your space now? The whole fold or the whole corral. Rabbi Yehoshua and Rabbi Akiva say, Ein lo ela arba amot. No. He doesn't have the whole area in which he can move around. He only has the small little amount of private space that we call, for real, arba amot. We're not expanding that to the whole enclosed in area. They don't recognize an enclosed area as equivalent to four amot in this regard. Now, ma'ase sheba'u mipolandarsim. There was an instance where four Tana'im, these four sages, were coming from Plandrasim. Note explains to you that that's on the southern coast of Italy. It was a gateway to the sailing the Mediterranean Sea back to the Holy Land. It was towards the other direction too. You could catch your ship. So this was a seaport. And their ship was still in port when the Sabbath began. Their Sabbath residence for tichum purposes was therefore what? They're on the boat. Vehifliga sfinatam bayam. And their ship moves out to sea. They're on the boat. These four sages. Remember you have Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. What did they say about the fold in the corral? The whole thing. And then you had Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Akiva who says, no, sorry, only four amot. So their ship moves out to sea. The four of them are on it. Rabban Gamliel and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, guess what they did? They held by their shita. They held by their approach. And they moved about the whole ship. Because if it's Shabbat and I'm on a ship, I look at it like I'm brought to a sheepfold or a corral and I can move around the whole enclosed area. Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Akiva, lo zazu me arba amot. And Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Akiva didn't move from their little spot that they established for themselves for the whole Sabbath. You know, whether or not they're in like a little cabin room or what have you, ships at that time, how did passengers actually travel? This is an interesting little bit of reading on some of those ships that traveled between Italy and the Holy Land during that time. You had people sometimes on a deck. You had sometimes one floor underneath. You didn't have massive kind of transport ships built at the time, but you had a big enough ship where you had some inside space and some outside space. They remind you, they could have said that you go around the whole thing. You can go upstairs, downstairs, in and out of whatever kind of cabin there was. They didn't say anything like that. They just said the whole ship is an enclosed area. Maybe we're only talking about a ship that has one deck, like a sailboat that has only one kind of deck. Maybe they're talking about something more. Not exactly clear. There's some discussion on the matter. But they see the whole thing as if it was the fold or the corral. Shiratzu l'hachamir al'atzman. Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Akiva didn't budge because they wanted to be what's called machmir. Strict. Their version of strict in this case is to stay in the one spot. Pam achat lo nichnesu lanamal ad shechashecha. Once, though, on another occasion, the ship did not enter the port until it was already dark and the Sabbath had begun. So we're talking Friday night. So you're out on a ship, you were just traveling, you were going to see the authorities in Rome. If you're some of these great Tanitic sages, you know, they had community there, by the way, in Rome. We know from the times that the temple still stood. We don't know how exactly far back it goes, but the Roman Jewish community is definitely ancient. And they get there and it's dark. And what happens? Amru lo Rabban Gamliel. They say to Rabban Gamliel, Ma'anu le'red? Can we get off the ship? Can we really get off the ship? This is our, what? This is our Tachum Shabbat. We have free range according to your system of outlook. This was our space for Shabbat. They pull in after it's dark. If this is my Tachum, am I allowed to get off and go to the other Tachum that's beyond the gangplank? I didn't make a Eruv there. It's not part of my 4,000 Amot. Oh, but maybe it is. Here's how he answers. Amar lahem, he says to them, Mutarim atem shekavar hayiti mistakel. It's permissible for you guys to get off the ship right now. Why? V'hayinu b'toch ha-tachum ad shelo chashecha. And we were within the tachum of the port before it became dark. The port, therefore, is the area in which we may walk. How does he know that?
You mentioned.
What are the possibilities? Right. So the possibilities are, A, he imagined the ship pulling into port, and by through his imagination and the imagination of the sage, whom they asked the halachic question, may we disembark? He was able to provide an answer and allow for something under the law. What's another possibility? How did he know that they were within the tachum of the port, the 2,000 amot of that port, and therefore the port was simply the 2,000 mark, and there was another, 2,000 beyond it?
He had his telescope with him again. Unless there was an incoming boat that navigated them, and then they told him you are in 2,000 yards.
So, Dan, if I didn't know the coming Gemara, and I didn't know that he had a telescope of sorts, because the Gemara is going to tell us that, and the note says it, I might have to, if I'm just trying to understand the Mishnah, take some stabs at how he comes up with an answer. And so my point is, in Mishnah reading, I can be completely informed by the Gemara, and the Gemara has an answer. The Gemara says he's got an instrument, and they have a machlokid, some of the Rishonim, some of the commentators, about what he actually has. A, is it simply a tube that he's hollowed out that with the certain size hole, he can tell basically within what's in focus that's within 2,000 amot, and it's very rudimentary? Or did he have some type of surveying instrument that in the ancient world really helped you measure in a very exact way? And that was the instrument that's mentioned later on page 43. We're on page 41 of the Gemara in Eruvin right now.
Gamliel is a liberal thinking. You know that. So he probably simply told, let me evaluate or examine all the repercussions of not leaving versus leaving. It's Shabbat. I don't want to be stuck here.
First, the captain will not allow him to stuck.
Rabbi Yoshua, Rabbi Akiva are in the same boat with me. So if I stay here, we probably can't even have a minion tomorrow. Because
they're only fellows.
So he said, plus minus, we're within 2,000.
Let me ask you.
Much better off to leave the ship than to stay here.
Let me ask you something. By this example and his being liberal in his thinking, or using some of the kind of creative thinking that, again, I go back to the example of the exchange about the body and why we could even lay eyes on it and maybe appreciate it for a minute, and that's within a spirit of Shabbat. I'm not going into the bar. I'm not buying anything. It's on. I simply am enjoying this. I'm not really worried that a Jew did this and broke the law. Therefore, I'm not going to gain. I take no technicality. I take no moment to stop and say, technically, I'm over. I'm transgressing. Right? So Rabbi Gamliel is creative in his approach. He says that we're going to have a better Sabbath out there. There's a shul that I want to give a lecture in. I was supposed to be here before the Shabbat. Really, how could I let people down? Any of this type of thinking. Do you think, in the way that it's presented here, that Rabbi Yoshua and Rabbi Akiva got off the boat after his example?
Well,
or not?
Conspicuously, they don't present the same question. In the previous issue, they both had a chance to express a point of view. Here they don't. So we don't know exactly what they would have done. But maybe they would have said, if Rabbi Yoshua says we are ready within 2,000 amot, in this particular case, I'm going to accept his, not his theory about
Rome,
but his measurement of distance theoretically.
Right, right. Maybe they find a legal way to accept it, since he legally made a ruling about a tichum instead of just the Ruach Shabbat issue, the spirit of Shabbat. I know we would have a better spirit of Shabbat if we got off the boat. And let's take the notion of the captain who's going to tell him to get off the boat, and if I have to be in compliance, and if I have to be in compliance, don't I want to be in compliance from my sense of what's legal and right about the Sabbath versus simply complying with some law of a ship captain that might also have informed the reality of what's going on here? But I imagine, getting back to Akiva and Yoshua, that if he could really have talked about this by way of the Tichum, maybe they would feel a little bit more comfortable, and that's why we don't have a retort, and that it's left with Rabban Gamliel. And Rabban Gamliel is able to establish how we kind of do this if we pull in a little late. You know, it's kind of the question of, if you're in motion traveling in today's world and you're really serious about your Shabbat observance and you get to a certain point on the 405 and you're stuck in traffic in Los Angeles and you're supposed to be going out to Manhattan Beach to the synagogue there from the valley, and it's this huge stretch of highway. Yeah. Can I say that we were in motion already and therefore my travel is not actually breaking the Sabbath? There would be those who say we have to be creative like that within our halachic reasoning if I'm serious about not traveling at all. There are those who would say you simply park your car on the side of the road, you get out, and you put your 2 feet to the ground and you walk.
Yeah, but you don't
have
Tichum Shabbat.
You
can walk only 2,000
now.
Yeah, I
suppose so. At that moment, your car is your Tichum.
So it's only 2,000.
Oh.
So that's it. So you get stuck.
Or 2,000 plus another two. So you know, it depends again. How far am I away? But this moment is another moment where who is really making the law for us? Rabban Gamliel. And it's important to note that his prescription of law and his decision-making is seen here at the end of this Mishnah as a way to evaluate a situation in order to achieve the kind of Sabbath that he and the sages want to achieve. If you look at what I included a little spot about his telescope on the next page. Rabban Gamliel had a hollow tube. It's at the bottom left-hand side of 43B2. Pam achat lo nichnazu
l'namal. Number three.
Number three on the bottom left-hand side. Shifoferet hayitalo l'Rabban Gamliel. Rabban Gamliel had a hollow tube. Shehayam ma'bita tofeba al payim amah bayabasha, with which he was able to look in sight a distance of 2,000 amot on land. And similarly, 2,000 amos at sea. It was by using this instrument as their ship approached port that Rabban Gamliel was able to determine that the ship had been within the tichum of the port when night fell. Okay, turn the page. So just by way of explaining this concept of Eruv and area further, I want to, on page 5, look at the Mishnah. The following Mishnah and subsequent Gemara treat the principle of Bereira, retroactive designation. This principle allows one to institute a legal process and make its validation conditional upon events which have not yet occurred and whose outcome cannot now be predicted. The validity of this principle is the subject of dispute among many Tanaim. Our Mishnah accepts the validity of Breira and illustrates how it might be used. Madne Adam al Eruvo v'omer. A person may attach a condition to his Eruv after placing two Eruvin. Okay? Rashi explains it's about being worried that the tax collector, the non-Jewish tax collector, is going to come and want a conversation with me, and I have to run the other way. That is not the worst kind of attitude that comes through with non-Jews and Jews in the Gemara, but it's not the same as the non-Jew who might draw some water with whose animals I might commingle, and we would all walk out as neighbors, him with his flock, mine, me with mine. You know, this is a little bit of a different situation. So ultimately he's going to place two Eruvin, right? And he's going to say that if he comes from this side, that retroactively the Eruv on the other side is going to be the one that takes effect. And if he comes from that side, I can run this way.
But Jews don't like to pay taxes.
Are you trying to suggest that they were early Republicans?
Probably. I thought we learned that they used Jews to collect the taxes.
One guy. Yeah, you know.
They did have tax collectors. In some cases, they liked paying taxes because they felt safe by governments, or a little bit safer, and they would trust the authorities, you know, as far as they could throw them, because these authorities established some courts that were decent enough, right? But, and that, by the way, that's the Pirkei Avot that says pray on behalf of the government, pray for the welfare of the state. That's the attitude that comes through with that Mishnah. But then on the other hand, they're making Eruvin to kind of skip away because, you know, maybe the tax collector not only is going to say, you owe me X, Y, Z, but he's going to demand a little bit more from the community.
Yeah, but then we did not
This is on Shabbat. He's coming to the
just
tax
because
collector.
It's Shabbat.
Right.
Exactly.
And then, right. Well, it doesn't have to be. But there, it can be. And then plus, I was going to say, the particular here is we're talking about Tehum Shabbat. And we're talking about Tehum Shabbat because it is a Shabbat. And on Shabbat, I'm not going to make any business dealings because I'm establishing the culture of the Sabbath. And they're not abiding by my culture of the Sabbath. By the way, when did we already hear a case in our Gemara when authorities were helpful to me on the Sabbath? Remember the tax collector of the Jews had a fire. And the authorities sent a brigade to actually put it out. So we know that there are times when it could be positive. And we could have a...
I don't want to read into this if I had to, you know, something about the Jews not wanting to pay taxes.
The major principle here is about the Shabbos principle. The major principle here is about Shabbos. It's true.
Don't
the Goyim know it's Shabbos? Fire.
You want to pay taxes, but you don't
want to
pay more than you have.
Okay, but don't the Gentiles know it's Shabbos?
But they do it.
The Gentiles might know it's Shabbat.
And they might know their home.
The Gentiles might want to come and disrupt the Shabbos order.
There's an idea.
The whole idea here that someone wants to pay taxes for services that are right and good is reflected already in the Mishnah. I want to point that out. For like what Dan is saying. For courts that are just, for services that I couldn't get otherwise, and for things that some of the rabbis in the Gemara are very happy to have. On the other hand, it could be about the breaking up of the Sabbath culture. And that's why even some of the discussion that's subsequent through the years on this Mishnah, even though it's very specifically about the Sabbath and not dealing with monetary issues because I'm looking to keep myself away from that, that there is some discussion regarding what the intentions are of the non-Jews. And this is always at bay whenever you have a Mishnah that deals with non-Jews. Why would you? You don't want to, but since it's been part of how we've discussed any Mishnah that has this kind of potential within it, or the case has, or the reality has a possibility of moving into this, breaking Shabbat mode, whether it's from my side or from someone trying to impose law on me from the outside, that tension could be there. But really what I'm interested in is the Eruv that was created, the retroactive look, the fact that it's about this tax collection issue here, and the fact that it's not about the tax collection issue in other places. So the reason why I brought it, and I don't want to carry this over to the next class, because the next class we're going to deal with more about the Shabbos Goy in general and how Jewish law developed in terms of what I say to a Sabbath Goy or a non-Jew in my neighborhood or a non-Jew in my orbit, hired or not, within my home for the Sabbath culture that I'm looking to create. Here, I want to point out that this Mishnah, while it's about taxes and dollars, there's another area in the Gemara where I'm making such eruvin, I'm making such conditional eruvs when sages are coming to town. I hear that sages are coming to town, and I want to go and hear this one in a lecture versus this one in a lecture. Or I want to go to that one, and neither are here yet, right? But when I get word through people that are within that tichum that Rabban Gamliel is coming to town and I want to go to that afternoon class that he's giving, then that retroactively takes effect, the Eruv I put to the west, and the one on the east is not working. That happened to be, in all of this coming together, that happened to make the three-dimensional picture of reading Talmud. That happened to be on today's Daf Yomi. That was today's page in Beitza. And Beitza means egg, and the tractate that we're currently in, with one more page to go, and then we'll transition to the next tractate for the daily cycle of Talmud learning, this is presenting a case in Beitza, and I have it here. The Mishnah is really not about anything having to do with that on page 7. I just included what the Mishnah was so that you could see that discussion of a Tichum is happening in Beitza as well, because that's really a tractate on Yontiv, on Chagim, and not about the Sabbath, but it applies to both, as I read to you at the beginning of Tractate Eruvin, that the area in which I can travel, walk, go, enjoy my Sabbath applies both on Sabbath and festivals. This page 37 to 38, the two previous pages already, if we're talking about being in the next night, this page presented this possibility that I could have an Eruv that would expand to meet my needs if I wanted to go and hear a certain sage give his afternoon Shabbat lecture. So that brings me to my sense that the Rabban Gamliel story and the relationship to the Tichum Shabbat, the area I have in order to enjoy my Sabbath, and how I create the possibility of an Eruv on either side of me, left or right, that will take effect post-reality, right, when a sage actually comes to town, that Eruv comes into effect and I can walk to that class, into that area, that's all wrapped up in mentioning Rabban Gamliel's case of disembarking from the ship. That the end Mishnah of a Perek wants to deeply expand the conversation about the Sabbath and add yet one more principle to those we have been dealing with in the Mishnayot, in the several Mishnahs that have made Perek Sheshesrei, 16. It can't possibly get to every law within the corpus of Shabbat, Sabbath laws in the entire tractate. But chapter 16 is doing a really good job on touching on many of the bases that we have to consider if we want to be Sabbath observant Jews. And the fact that we get back to the Sabbath lecture, which is part and parcel of the first Mishnah in the Perek, the first Mishnah in the chapter, that to me really rounds it out. And I don't think it's by happenstance. I don't think it's by happenstance. I think it's that multidimensional in terms of mentioning one case and sending you in your mind to the Gemara and the Mishnah and Eruvin in the one about boundaries and borders, and then the connection to the one in Beitza, the one in the egg of the holidays, the Yuntiv egg, and all of that comes around here. So I found that to be very enriching this week. I hope that you find that more than novel in terms of a connection. Let's...
question. Rabbi Gabriel, all his discussion about the vote, the invocation, is based on a crew that is not Jewish. What happened if the crew is Jewish? The whole argument is not there.
They wouldn't be working they wouldn't be working the ship on Shabbat.
So what?
They would protect against that. They would protect against that in their culture. Let's rise and count the Omer before we go. Hine nimuchan umzuman lekayem et dvar aseh shel sfirat haomer kamo shekatuv batorah usafartem lachem imocharat haShabbat מיום אביאכם את עומר הצנופה שבע שבתות תמימות תהיינה עד ממוחרת השבת השביעית תספרו 50 יום והקרבתם מנחה חדשה לאדוני הנני מוכן ומזומן ברוך אתה אדוני אלוהינו מלך העולם אשר קידשנו במצוותיו וציוונו על ספירת העומר היום שלושה ועשרים יום, שהם שלושה שבועות, ימים לעומר, ויש...